Hey, Berry besties. Welcome back to Life in the Berry Lane. If you caught part one of my conversation with Dr. Evan Nadler, you already know this series has completely reframed how I think about obesity, especially childhood obesity, and even more so, how childhood obesity relates to me personally. In part two, we're digging deeper into the myths, the medicine, and the mindset that keep people trapped in shame. Dr. Nadler and I talk about why weight loss is never as simple as eat less, move more. How GLP-1 medications and bariatric surgery actually work together, and why obesity deserves the same compassion and clinical respect as any other chronic disease. This one's part science, part story, and a whole lot of truth-telling. Let's ride. I know our brains try to make sense of the world around us, given our experiences that, you know, we've had ourselves. But just because we don't understand something completely doesn't mean that we can just pass a judgment on whatever the situation is or how a person lives. And to your point about, the desperation. When we spoke previously, I mentioned that I had childhood obesity and I'm a Gen Xer, so we didn't have cell phones then. And, we outside all the time playing, and I always outside playing hard and eating the same things as my brother. He's 5 years older than I am. So, you know, at some point he becomes a teenager and eats everything in sight, right? That happens with boys. But still, like for dinner, our meals at home, we're eating the same things, but he's a normal weight and I'm heavy. And when we were chatting before, I mentioned that like every year I gained like 20 pounds and I didn't understand. And you were impressed that I remembered how much I weighed at a given time. But it's because it was very traumatic for me. I didn't understand, like I could, you know, keep up with all my friends. And even sometimes they would be like, I need a snack. And I wasn't hungry. And I'm like, why do you need food? And, but it really is true, everything that you're saying, because, you know, that hypothalamic wall, that's a tongue twister, or set point is really a wall. And that wall has been there for me because I could get to a certain point, but then I just couldn't go any lower than what it was. And as I aged, you know, that point had gotten higher and higher. And yeah, it's very interesting that your body is very smart, and it does say, hey, this is what we're doing and we're not doing anything else.
Yep.
And so it's just like mind blowing.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, so actually, you know, after our conversation, I actually spoke to my book editor and my agent and said, you know, it hadn't occurred to me, but this is another market for people who might be interested in buying a book about childhood obesity, is not only people who have children who have obesity now, but people who have obesity now and had childhood obesity and no one ever explained it to them. They never, even in their adult world, really understood why their body was programmed so differently. So thank you for that. So, you know, mm-hmm. It helped, helped in telling people I'm working with to sort of understand who's out there, who might be a potential person interested in learning more. It's, again, the brain in general is sort of the organ in the body that we understand the least. Fat might be number two, but the brain is number one. And so we don't really understand how bariatric surgery, for instance, changes that hypothalamic set point and allows you to get that difference of 12 or 15. but it does. But it also doesn't allow you, most people, to get a difference of 20 or 30. So there's whatever the mechanisms are, and they're probably multiple, they work together. And it's one reason why I don't personally think the even the tri-agonists like retatrutide that are out there that are being developed as meds, I don't think they're ever going to be able to have the, they might be able to achieve the same amount of weight loss as surgery does, although I actually don't think so, but they might. But I don't think they'll ever be meds that you can stop. Like, I think they'll be meds that you still have to take. Whereas with surgery, in many cases, but not all, it does reset your set point and you don't necessarily go back up. They're sort of different buckets of patients who have surgery. And there's at least one bucket where people will lose their weight and just stay at that weight, you know, forever. But that's not to say the medications aren't great. It's just to say that I don't think they'll ever replace surgery. I think the world will morph to a paradigm where surgery and medications working together are going to be the strategy for many, many people. And it won't be either or, it'll be both. And we just have to sort of figure out how to make both work best in combination, you know, like how, you know, when to give the meds before, when to give the meds after, when does surgery fit in? How do you come up with a plan that helps patients the most? I think that's hopefully where we're going as a community, as a, you know, weight management community. But the science is still, it's getting better, and these new medications are helping us understand the science better, but there's still so much we don't really understand.
Yeah. It's definitely baffling. It's still, even after all that I've learned from you, because in our sort of pre-interview conversation, we talked forever and I learned so much and I'm so grateful for that. Particularly as things I didn't understand when I was a child, just hearing you talk, I was like, oh my gosh, now I understand. It's still a mystery, like, you know, how our set point gets where it is really and how we can adjust it or whatever. But, you know, at least I understand why. Sure. Why I had so much trouble.
Right. And why you hit the same brick wall. Why you hit the same brick wall at the same point all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, one of the things. Again, like, a lot of what I do is focused on getting people to not only understand themselves better, but also self-blame and shame is huge. And it's not just societal outside forces blaming and shaming, but the internal feelings of failure are really hurtful for patients. So I spend a lot of time trying to deal with the kids and their parents, just saying, listen, none of this is your fault. And if you can get past that, mm-hmm. I think it helps a lot of people. It helps them with their physical health, but I think it obviously helps with their mental health a lot as well.
So speaking of blaming and shaming, a lot of people will say that surgery or taking medications to lose weight, that's the easy way out. And I certainly have been in that camp in the past. What do you say to those people?
Well, again, first of all, talk to anyone who's had bariatric surgery and they'll tell you there's nothing easy about it. But the, you know, it's, again, it's sort of the stigma of obesity of the disease that persists. Like, is taking a statin the easy way out of high cholesterol? I mean, nobody says that. No one says, oh, don't take that statin, it's an easy way out. Nobody says, don't take your blood pressure medicine, that's an easy way out of controlling your hypertension, your high blood pressure. Nobody says that. So it's only obesity, right, that gets this sort of nonsense about, oh, you know, it's the easy way out if you do something other than, you know, starve yourself and exercise like a mad person. So, you know, I hope, and I actually think maybe it'll happen, but I hope that someday that people will take obesity treatment in the same light as they do sort of high blood pressure or hypercholesterolemia, and that, you know, maybe people will just take their oral GLP-1 every day instead of taking their statin every day. And they actually won't need a statin because they'll be on this oral GLP-1. And they won't need their blood pressure medicine. So they may actually be able to take one medication, an oral GLP-1, as opposed to taking two or three for their blood pressure, their kidney protection, and their cholesterol. So I think what I'm hoping what's going to change is the economics, because, you know, people don't really care about health in America. I don't want to sound too sour on the American healthcare system, but it's never actual health that drives changes. It's money that drives changes. So if it becomes cheaper for somebody to take one GLP-1 oral medication a day versus three, you know, versus statin, high blood pressure medicine, and kidney protection medicine, if it becomes cheaper for people to get one pill instead of three, that'll change the paradigm. That'll be the big shift. But until that happens, mm-hmm. until GLP-1s come out and until they're cheap enough, we're going to be stuck in this easy way out discussion, which again makes no sense because it's not easy. Taking GLP-1s
is very difficult.
Yeah, taking GLP-1s is not easy. I mean, people who take GLP-1s often have lots of side effects. They often don't, they forget to eat. They don't keep themselves hydrated. So it's none of weight management is easy. It's just not easy.
So as you're describing this, I'm laughing and it's totally knowing laughter because I am, as I mentioned in our previous conversation, I am on a GLP-1 because my weight stalled and then I started creeping up. And so they put me on my bariatric office, put me on Mounjaro. And to be completely honest, since I had bariatric surgery almost 2 years ago, I have not felt hunger at all. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy for me to forget to eat, which I feel like the universe is maybe punishing me because I always said to these skinny people who would say they forgot to eat, how on earth do you forget to eat? I never forget to eat. My stomach growls. Well, now my stomach doesn't growl and I forget to eat. But it's even more difficult on the Mounjaro because I'm not even thinking about food.
Right.
So, and not only do I not feel hungry, but I'm not thinking about food. And then the restriction that I feel makes it difficult to eat enough.
Yeah.
I also think
the bariatric world, well, the weight management world is hopefully working towards better support for people like you, like not just support, meaning emotional support, physical, medical support, but like being able to actually assess your body composition on the day to day and that you're, you know, not hydrated enough and that you, it's actually a project I'm sort of working on with a company where if we can integrate everything so that we know exactly what you're doing every day and how it's affecting you, maybe we can send you reminders or somehow to your phone say, hey, you haven't had your 64 ounces of water today or whatever you're missing, and try to help remind you to do the things you need to do to stay healthy while you're on your GLP-1 or while you've had, or after you've had surgery, or both after surgery and on your GLP-1, and not necessarily, again, because there's too much focus on the weight loss itself as opposed to, you know, what's healthy. And what's healthy is, you know, you need a protein for breakfast every day. Everybody needs a protein for breakfast every day. And if you're on Mounjaro or if you've had surgery, that can often be really hard to do or remember to do. Mm-hmm. It's just, again, and people don't really understand that if you actually starve yourself and eat nothing, you actually slow down your weight loss. We were talking about the Fit for TV documentary where the guy was eating 600 calories a day, but burning 5,000 or something ridiculous. And, you know, no one would tell him to do that. If they were trying to optimize weight loss, they would say, you still need to eat, you know, 1,800, 2,000 calories a day, protein, you know, and work out, and then you'll lose the weight.
And with that high of a burn.
Yeah. And then, you know, you'll preserve your muscle mass, which will be good for your metabolism in the long term and for your functioning in the long term. But, you know, those poor guys on that show are just, you know, that's a whole nother, it's a whole nother story for another day. But those poor people were really taken advantage of.
I feel I agree with you completely. And I did watch that documentary in just one go because I couldn't look away. But, you know, I feel really fortunate to have the care that I have from my bariatric office, because I know a lot of people don't have, it blows my mind because a lot of people don't have what I have. And I think it should be at least standard. Like, this should be the minimum. But every time I have an appointment, they check my whole body composition. And I know your composition can change day to day. Like you mentioned, hydration, that is very much dependent on the day. But given I have a lot of muscle mass because I lift weights, and so my protein goal for the day is listed as greater than 80 grams. So should be 80 to 100 grams, but greater than 80 grams. And for my hydration, I need greater than 80 ounces of fluids a day. And when I hit that, I feel great. And I can also tell a difference in my, not just how I feel physically, but my body, like it will let go of things. And I mentioned that I couldn't, you know, I have trouble eating and stuff. So like, they want to know, how are you, you know, are you eating, what are you eating kind of things. And I'm just honest, you know, I am having trouble eating. And so like, I do protein, like I'm sitting here with a 30 gram protein shake. I have to hit that protein goal. I don't want to lose the muscle. That's hard work getting that muscle built up. And it's important to have it in order to, you know, to burn calories. Like, you burn more if you have lean muscle, but I'm not trying to have my muscle turn into fat. It's hard work. So I, you know, if I have to drink shakes to hit my goal, then I will.
Yeah. Well, again, that's
and ideally you eat your calories.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, well, yes, but protein, I mean, it's one of the reasons why the war on ultra processed foods isn't as cut and dry as the people are making it out to be, because there are a lot of ultra processed foods like what you're drinking right there that are actually really helpful and really good for you. They just have to be processed properly. The one of the reasons why surgery has gotten a bad rap over the years is because not all the surgeons have programs that are providing the sufficient support after surgery, like the one you're in currently. And so people, you know, so some people don't do as well after surgery, and then surgery gets a bad rap, or, you know, it makes it an uphill battle for others who really want to provide all that support, because there are places that don't. And I think part of the problem is that, again, access to care is hard for people. It's why telemedicine, I think, has a huge role in weight management, especially because with the advent of all these wearables and being able to upload data from your home to your providers, so you don't actually have to take a day off of work and actually go to the office and get stuff done. I think that helps access to care. And, you know, I think in the pediatric world, which is my world, there are just so few places that even offer surgery or offer comprehensive weight management that anything is better than what's out there now. In the adult world, it's hit or miss. There are places that are great, and then there are places that aren't as great. And it's hard for people to figure that out when they're pursuing surgery or medications or anything. You know, they go to, let's say, you know, Hims or Hers online, and they think it's great because they can just put in their data and get a prescription mailed to them. But they don't realize that that's actually not necessarily enough and might be harmful, actually, and especially if they're getting a compounded med or a gray market med that they don't really know enough about, and then they don't really have a provider to talk to about it. So again, hopeful that things are changing, and that hopeful that people are sort of realizing that there's a lot to weight management, a lot more than doing a procedure, a lot more than prescribing a med, a lot more than just telling people to diet and exercise more. It's just, you know, all of the arrows in the quiver have to be at the ready, and then you just got to figure out how to use them at the right time for the right, you know, for the right purpose, and optimize the overall product that we're giving people.
You mentioned the cutting the ultra processed foods, or just move more. Can you speak more about why that falls short?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, I'm not a diet and exercise hater. I try to eat right most of the time, although I definitely don't do it all the time. And I try to exercise the recommended 3 to 4 times a week of 30 minutes or more of vigorous exercise or whatever the recommended daily allowance is. But it's hard for me. It's hard for everybody. Like, time is short in everybody's life. We all could do nothing but pursue good food and exercise, then we'd be a lot healthier, but we all have to work and do other things. But the most intensive behavioral programs are something called IHBLTs, Intensive Healthy Behavior and Lifestyle Treatment Programs. And you go on the CDC website, you can find these programs. And they require basically 26 contact hours. So think about that. They're 52 weeks in a year. So 26 contact hours is either an hour a week for half the year, 6 months, or an hour every other week for a full year. And with that amount of contact time, the average patient loses 5 to 7% of their total body weight, which is great, except for if you weigh 300 pounds, 5 to 7% is 15 to 21 pounds. So at best, you go from 300 to 280, and that's after putting in an hour of time a week for 6 straight months. So if you tell people, if you told people in the beginning, listen, you're going to put in an hour a week for half of a year, and you're going to lose 20 pounds, most people would say, no thanks. Like, that's just an amazing amount of effort to get 20 pounds. Some people would say yes, and some people do. But that's the reason why I say diet and exercise have fallen short, is because even with all that commitment, most people who weigh 300 pounds need to lose more than 20 pounds to get to a healthy weight. So yes, it'll make you metabolically healthier for sure, 100%, but it won't cure your obesity, and it won't fix your, well, frankly, it doesn't fix your hypothalamic set point. So when you stop doing that program, you're likely to just drift back up over time, which would be even more frustrating after you've just spent half a year busting your tail to lose weight. So, you know, the diet and exercise paradigm in and of itself is not sufficient. It's certainly helpful, and it certainly helps with maintenance, and it certainly helps with overall health. But again, I think it's because of the messaging that it's sort of, it just needs to be messaged more as like an adjunct to the other interventions, as opposed to something that would be suitable for most people with obesity to lose enough weight.
So I'm going to have to edit this out, but my dogs went after my cat. And so that's why I'm looking around,
yeah.
But my husband's got it under control now. So
I did hear the dogs going off a little bit in the
Yeah.
Sometimes I think the unedited versions are okay too. You know what I mean? Like it just makes it a little bit more real. But
it's human, right? Yeah. Like my other podcast is the High Functioning Disaster. So like this is totally fitting for that.
Yeah. Well, most of these things are, yeah, like, I think the podcasts are great and I like to try to give as much information as possible, but I don't want it to be too, like, if it's too perfect, it's boring, right? You need a little bit of stuff going on in the background.
Little bit of yakety sax going on.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to circle back to, you said eight, is it, oh, what is the something H? BLT.
IHBLT. Totally... So the only way I can remember
IHBLT.
The only way I can remember it, because I'm a weight management person, is the BLT part. So I always think about a BLT.
Yeah.
Like it's IHBLT. So that's the only way I can get it straight.
So I want to ask a question for, I mean, like you said an hour a week for 26 weeks or an hour every other week for an entire year. What would you say to somebody who says, why don't they do more than 1 hour?
Oh, well, I mean, again, if we all had unlimited time to spend on our health, we would all be a lot healthier. I think the contact hours that are recommended in those IHBLTs are based on, I think, other options that have been tried that haven't shown to be any more effective. And so that's what they've sort of decided is the minimum contact hours, and doing more doesn't necessarily get you more weight off. And, again, I guess I would say, I don't, especially in the pediatric world, when it's not just the kid who has to spend that time, but it's the parent who has to, again, usually get off from work, because these are usually in-person visits, usually during 9 to 5. It's just a lot for people. And I think I posted this on LinkedIn recently. There was an article in the Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics subsection that was talking about the ethics of people who only offer lifestyle for weight management. And one of the points this article made was that offering lifestyle to people when they don't have the resources to make it happen is unethical in their mind, but at least without telling people that there's medication and surgery that could be more appropriate for their particular socioeconomic or life circumstance. And I thought that was I posted it because I thought it was a really interesting argument, that it's like asking people to do something that you know they cannot do. You know that they cannot spend 26 hours doing a program because single parent home and mom can't get off work or whatever. Like, take your pick of the challenges that we all face in the day to day. These authors said that that's unethical. And I thought to myself, it's a really interesting point. And I agree that it's unethical is a strong word. I was trying to think to myself as I was reading it, is unethical like the right word, or is it just bad doctoring or bad, which isn't, you don't mean to be ethically insufficient, but you're just providing bad advice. You're just being a bad doctor or a bad provider or whatever. And I think they're slightly different, because I don't think the people who are doing it mean to be unethical. I just think that they don't know any better. But anyway, it speaks back to your point that like even doing those 26 hours is a super huge challenge for lots and lots of people. So to ask people to do more, I just think is unreasonable. And most people aren't going to be able to do it. So. I think they all have a role in the management of obesity, And it's really important for providers to try to help people figure out which of the different interventions and in which combination and maybe in which order they should be pursued.
What is the danger of oversimplifying obesity into eat less, move more? Or maybe there are multiple dangers.
It's like the danger is that you don't help anybody. You just stigmatize people more and tell them that they're, you know, quote unquote, failing at their weight management because they can't diet and exercise enough to get themselves optimal health. We talked a little bit about epigenetics and about we alluded to the concept of the intergenerational transmission of obesity, which is parents passing on obesity to their offspring. One of the big dangers of diet and exercise alone is it will not stop the intergenerational transmission of obesity from parent to child because it's not enough of an intervention. It doesn't change the epigenetics, and thus the cycle of obesity that runs in families will just continue to go. But I chuckled because there are just so many dangers like that. It amazes me that we still have people who believe that and who espouse that. It really boggles my mind because it's so scientifically debunked. It's so scientifically wrong that I don't even know how people get away with saying it still. Like, I just don't even, like, there's so much data out there that says the opposite. So, like, what has to be, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised because they're, you know, the topic of the day are vaccines, where there are so much data out there showing that they're safe, yet there's still very vocal people who say they aren't. So maybe I shouldn't be surprised that the loud minority still outpaces the scientific majority.
I think a lot of it is ignorance, and ignorance is incredibly frustrating when those who are ignorant don't want to know any different or better.
Yeah.
Or if they do learn, they don't care enough, or they just don't want to do or be better.
Yeah. And again, while the word you used is probably appropriate, I try to not, and I try to be less inflammatory, so I don't call people the I word. I'll use, I guess, uneducated or whatever. But I think that you're right. It doesn't frustrate me if you don't know something about a topic. What frustrates me is if you are unwilling to learn about it and unwilling to change your opinion on it, even though you're uneducated. Like, if you don't know anything about it, keep your mouth shut. Don't get on the internet and tell people. Like, I had to take a deep breath and not respond to the post that I saw today from this guy about fat kids, quote unquote fat kids, because I would never use that term, because I was going to reply and I was going to say something like, you know, how off base this person was and how mean and spiteful and all those things. But then I remembered the number one rule of social media, which is that every like comment and reply generates more circulation of the hateful comment. So I just decided, you know what, I'm just not going to reply. I'm just going to ignore it, because if I give it volume, if I amplify it by responding to it, that's worse than just ignoring it. So so I was proud of myself. I took a deep breath and I stopped myself from revenge posting. But yeah, it's amazing. Like, it's just amazing to me that people, like, I was thinking to myself, who is this guy that, like, he's commenting about childhood obesity to one of the world's experts on childhood obesity and basically telling me that I'm wrong and that fat kids are just fat. Like, who does this guy think he is that he would do that? And again, why be so mean? Like, even if you believe that, why do you feel the need to post it? Like, what is wrong with you as a human? Like, are you not, you know, and then of course the joke is always, he must not be loved, must not have anything else in his life going on because he's taking the time to do these things. But anyway, I just, it's probably taken me my whole life to show enough self-restraint not to respond, because I'm pretty sure I would have responded like a year ago or 2 years ago, and I probably would have responded if it weren't giving him more clicks and likes by responding. But anyway, I was pissed off and annoyed, and you know, that's why I'm talking about it now, for catharsis, make myself feel better.
And that was part two of my conversation with Dr. Evan Nadler. Every time we talk, I walk away with a mix of gratitude and fire. Gratitude for the clarity he brings, and fire for how much work still needs to be done to end the shame and misinformation around obesity. In part three, we'll unpack what makes childhood obesity a different disease altogether, why some kids develop diabetes so early, and how trauma, genetics, and even pollution can rewrite the body's programming. Be sure you're subscribed to Life in the Berry Lane so you can come along for the next ride. Hey, besties. Quick disclaimer as we wrap up. I'm not a doctor, dietitian, therapist, or any kind of medical professional. I'm just sharing my personal bariatric journey and the experiences, opinions, and stories that come with it. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear on Life in the Berry Lane should ever be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, even when my guests are professionals. Your body, your health, and your journey are unique. So always talk with your surgeon, your doctor, or your qualified healthcare team before making any changes to your diet, medication, exercise plan, or anything related to your care. Thanks for riding along.